Amen. All right. Well, good morning, everybody. I don't know what's happening, Robbie. It's okay. I'm going to touch nothing, and I'll let you kind of sort through it. Did I go backwards? Is that? There it is. Okay. And he's touching stuff. I'm not going to touch anything. So I remember when I was a little kid, and this is like thousands of years ago, but maybe I was like around 10 years old or so, and my mom took my brother and I to this mall. And, you know, malls weren't as prolific as they were like maybe in the 80s or whatever. This is back in the 60s. But I still remember this mall. And this is one of those things. Back in those days, my mom would take us and she would say to my brother and I, you know, you guys go do your thing and we'll meet back at the entrance here in, you know, a couple hours. Which, you know, mind you, there are no cell phones and hardly any security cameras anywhere. It's amazing to me. We were just released into the wild, and I still have trouble wrapping my mind around that. But anyway, in those days, there were also no arcades in the malls. I mean, this is way before video games. This is before Pac-Man. This is before Pong, if anybody even remembers that. But there were arcade games. I mean, they had pinball and little shooting galleries. And this particular mall had a little nook in it where they had a few of these games set up. And one of them that attracted my attention, I was drawn to it like a light shining down from heaven, was this submarine game. And it was all analog, but it was, you put your head into the periscope, look through the periscope, and little ships would pass by on a little conveyor, and you'd fire the torpedo. I'm seeing some people nod. Do you remember that game? You fired, and all it was a little light that went across. It was a forced perspective kind of thing. But if you hit one of those ships, the whole thing would go like that and light up red. And it was a technological marvel to me. I loved that thing. And I had a whole bunch of quarters that I had saved up. And I saw this game, and you got three games for a quarter. And so I just started playing that thing. I got lost in that game. So lost that at one point a security guard was tapping me on the shoulder and asking me where my parents were. And I came up out of that periscope and realized the mall had the lights off and the gates were down over the stores. And I said, well, I was supposed to meet my mom at the entrance. And he said, well, come on. And so he's, okay, you know, I'm 10 years old and following this guy. And I look up and I finally see my mom, and she's, you know, a wreck. And she sees me, and she actually came running towards me, and she grabbed me and she hugged me so tight. And then she shook me so hard, I almost lost my teeth at that moment. And she began describing to me the elaborate punishments that I had in store for me. Because she said, you know, I went to every toy store that was in this place, and you weren't in any of the places I thought you'd be. I was so scared. I think it's possible that most adults have memories of times where their parents lost track of them somewhere along the way. I would even say that most parents have moments that they don't want to discuss, but where they lost track of their kids. I know we had that at least once. So it's nice to know that sort of thing even happens in the Bible. It's, you know, and listen, that's not an excuse, mind you. I don't have to keep track of my kids. That's biblical. No, but it reminds us that the scriptures are full of real life people who went through real life events. And so we're coming back to our study in Luke today. And if you've got a Bible and you'd like to follow along, go to Luke chapter 2, please. Last week, we read about Mary and Joseph taking the infant Jesus to the temple, and they had two prophetic encounters with people that were identifying Jesus as the awaited Messiah and Savior of the world. And now today in the narrative, we skip ahead 12 years to the only story in the canonized Gospels about Jesus' childhood. We're going to read about a time when Jesus' parents lost track of him, where they had gone on a family trip, and where Jesus, much like in Home Alone, gets left behind in the city. And we're going to consider what we learn about that event, not only about Jesus, about his nature, but also about our own pursuits as people who are followers of Jesus, who are following in his footsteps. So if you're there in Luke chapter 2, we're going to pick up where we left off last week, starting in verse 21. And we're going to read the whole account because I feel like it's one of those things that needs to just be kept together. And then we're just going to kind of consider what we learn from it. So if you're there, starting, did I say 21 verse? So starting in verse 41, sorry, it says, every year, Jesus' parents went to Jerusalem for the Passover festival. When Jesus was 12 years old, they attended the festival as usual. After the celebration was over, they started home to Nazareth. But Jesus stayed behind in Jerusalem. His parents didn't miss him at first because they assumed he was among the other travelers. But when he didn't show up that evening, they started looking for him among their relatives and friends. And when they couldn't find him, they went back to Jerusalem to search for him there. 3 days later, they finally discovered him in the temple. Yeah, right? They finally discovered him in the temple, sitting among the religious teachers, listening to them and asking questions. All who heard him were amazed at his understanding and his answers. His parents didn't know what to think. Son, his mother said to him, why have you done this to us? Your father and I have been frantic, searching for you everywhere. But why did you need to search? He asked. Didn't you know that I'd be in my father's house? Well, they didn't understand what he meant. And then he returned to Nazareth with them and was obedient to them. And his mother stored all these things in her heart. Jesus grew in wisdom and in stature and in favor with God and all the people. Okay, so the law of Moses required that all Jewish people make an annual pilgrimage, an annual trip to Jerusalem to celebrate the Passover. There's actually several annual trips that they're supposed to make, but this was the most prominent of them all. And most people would have made an attempt to make this trip. And since people are coming from all over the region, I mean from everywhere in the world, and especially in the neighboring areas like Galilee, the population in Jerusalem would swell way beyond its normal boundaries. So you got to think in terms of like spring break on steroids. I mean, just people everywhere, traffic jams and everything. We have to imagine the caravans of people that are streaming into the city. And then, of course, the encampments all around the city for where people have to stay. So it's kind of like a outdoor music festival, the tents everywhere and people wandering around and children running and animals. You can hear the animals everywhere. And the temple courts would have been, it's a religious holiday. So the temple courts would have been one of the major focal points of the festival. And everybody would be jamming into that area. Tons of people. If nothing else, just to be a good tourist and at least get a selfie, you know, in front of the sanctuary or whatever. And of course, selfies took a long time back then because you had to carve them in stone. So it could have been up to 3 days for that. One of the regular activities in the vast court of the Gentiles, which was the court that surrounded the main sanctuary, and all lined all around it are these colonnades, these shaded colonnades. One of the things that went on under those colonnades very regularly was teaching sessions and midrashim, questions and debates about the scriptures. Rabbis and scribes would gather their disciples, and people would often just sit in and listen to the discussion that they were having there. So just like I was drawn to that submarine game, Jesus happened to see these things going on and got drawn to that. Who's the more spiritual there? But either way, didn't even cost him a quarter. He just went up and was there. And so the family, of course, was busy doing other things, getting other selfies in front of other tourist spots. And Jesus sort of drops from view. And so when the week is up and everybody's packing up and you're getting your family together and you're getting the caravan all together and you're checking the oil and the donkey and all the stuff that you got to do to make ready for this trip, Jesus kind of is lost in the mix in their thinking. Maybe, you know, one of the neighbor kids had to happen to be there while they were counting off the heads and they thought he was with them, but he actually wasn't. And so it's a 3-day journey from Jerusalem to Nazareth. So on the first day, when they stop for the evening and they're making encampment, they're cooking dinner and preparing things. And Mary just happens to say to Joseph, I just feel like I'm forgetting something. And Joseph goes, I left the garage door open. I think that's it. And she goes, yeah, maybe that's it. And then suddenly sits bolt upright and says, Jesus. And in fast motion, they're running around to all of the neighbors, all the other encampments that are there and talking to the neighbors and talking to the close friends and the relatives. And everybody's saying, I haven't seen him. And they meet back together and they look at each other for a minute. And then they slowly look down the road that leads back to Jerusalem. At least that's how it's going out in my mind. But they've been gone for 1 day. So they realize that they've got to pack up and on their own head back into Jerusalem. So it takes a day to return. So on the third day, they're going everywhere, everywhere that they had visited in the city. They go to the arcade. He's not there. He's not at the falafel hut where they had eaten earlier. But finally, they wander into the temple courts, and there, sitting amidst a midrash discussion about the scriptures, is their 12-year-old son, Jesus. And as I said before, this was a normal practice. People would do this regularly, and the rabbis would do this regularly. People would always gather around, and it wasn't that unusual for young people to be involved in that as well. From the time a young man is a little boy until he's 12 years old, he's actually being taught regularly the Hebrew scriptures in the synagogues of his hometown. So it wasn't unusual for a scribe to be teaching younger people or younger people to be involved in these discussions. At the age of 13, it would be determined whether or not a young man was going to follow a rabbi and be a person of the scriptures, or whether he's going to follow his father's trade, whatever that might be. Often, when we look at this scene or we see pictures of this scene, Jesus is shown as sitting in the center of it and doing all the teaching that's there. In fact, that's kind of one of those, what do you call those things that everybody has an idea about, that it's not the same thing? A lie? Well, no. Like everybody, when you think about the Mandela effect, where everybody assumes Jesus is there and doing all the teaching, when in reality, that's not what the text says at all. He's actually just participating. He's auditing the class. He's sitting there and listening and asking a question if one is a pertinent time, or he's answering a question that might be asked by a rabbi. But what gets everyone's attention there is not necessarily his youth, but at his youth, he's so advanced in his knowledge of the scriptures. Now, this is interesting because Luke is being very intentional about this. We have a picture of a 12-year-old boy impressing seasoned teachers with his knowledge. And so this is a story of a young prophet and a future leader ready to emerge on the scene. And the story echoes something that we find actually in Rome, the Roman heroes like Augustus. Because Augustus, if you remember me talking about this before, was the first Roman emperor. He was called, he titled himself the Son of God, and he was called the one who was going to bring peace to the world. And he was said to have been exceptionally educated at an early age, seen as someone who had wisdom that was beyond his peers. In fact, there's a story from Roman history that at the age of 12, Augustus made his debut by delivering the funeral sermon for Julia, the sister of Julius Caesar. So again, we've got these parallels going on, but they're contrasting parallels. And so Luke is, in this declaration here, is saying that this is the true king. This is the true Son of God. This is the one who's going to be bringing peace to earth. Anyway, when Jesus' parents find him, his mom reacts like my mom did when she found me. She's probably super relieved, but she's also probably super annoyed. And so she rebukes him. And she says to him, how could you do this to us? Like every parent would say to their kid, what are you trying to kill me for? And Jesus speaks for the first time in Luke's gospel. And think about this. So he's had angels testifying about him, not only Gabriel, but a choir of angels. He's had shepherds come in and testify about him. He's had holy men and prophets speak about who he is. But here, for the first time, Jesus speaks for himself in Luke's gospel, and he begins by pushing back at his mother. He begins by saying, Mom, why are you searching for me everywhere? Didn't you know where I'd be? I'd be in my father's house. Which is very interesting, because if you look at what she has said to Jesus, she said, who and she have been frantic? Your father and I have been frantic. And Jesus clearly is correcting that. And he's saying, indicating that he was in his father's house. So this is an early self-declaration of his own divine nature and purpose. One of those rare things that we have. Now, it's unlikely that he meant, when he said my father's house, it's unlikely that he meant just the temple in that, but rather house as the Greco-Roman world would have understood it, as household. So it would include the temple, but also the activities that represented what the father is up to in this world. So Jesus was pointing to the transcendence of his relationship with God the Father over everything else, including his relationship with his biological family. Jesus knew who he was, and everything from this point of the story flows from that awareness. So we learn about Jesus' divine nature in this section, but we also learn about ourselves as we read this. Since we're followers of Christ, meaning that we follow his example, we follow his teachings, his way, then as Christians, our understanding of self is based on our relationship with God. So we could say to be God's child is our primary identity. Obviously, Jesus was unique as the Son of God, the unique Son of God. But John 1 tells us that as many as believed on Jesus, to them he gave the power to become the children of God. And listen, so we got to clarify this, because all of humanity is God's children, right? We know that. We understand from a creative sense. As Creator God, all human beings are his children in that sense. But when we go back to family and household, in that ancient understanding of things, there's a differentiation in this. What we understand from the biblical story is that all of humanity actually was estranged from the household of God, from the family of God, in exile from God. But through Jesus, we've returned to our original place as God's children, as God's family, meaning that we are representing God and his purposes into this world through Jesus. So our relationship to God as his children is our core identity. If we want to understand who we are, we have to start there. We are God's children whom he loves. Our understanding of self has to be built on that. Because see, the thing, one of the grounding realities of all of life comes down to identity. We struggle with that on a regular basis as human beings. Who am I? Am I valuable? Am I loved? What's my purpose here? And 1 John 3:1 declares, "See how very much our Father loves us, for he calls us his children, and that is what we are." To realize that that's who we are right now, not in some heavenly state, but right now, we are God's children, and that tells us that we're valuable. That tells us that we're loved. That tells us that we have purpose beyond anything imaginable within the natural constraints of life. I think if we could really grasp that as Christians, it would make the church a radical entity in this world. If we really could grasp hold of and build our sense of identity on the reality that we've come into God's household, that our calling in this life is to bear the family resemblance to the world. I also think that's why the enemy works overtime to obfuscate who we are, to get us confused about that. Years ago, Robbie and I experienced somebody hacking our bank debit card. Have you ever gone through that? Identity theft on something like that? That's an awful feeling, isn't it? It's the worst. It's a weird sense, like, you know, somebody's just taken, you know, your personal information like that and is misrepresenting you even in the world. So we had to go through the process of disputing the charges and waiting for the bank to declare, yes, we realize that wasn't you, and now your account is restored. And you get that great sense of relief that comes from something like that. The Satan is the great identity thief. It's ongoing with these whispers to us that cause us to doubt our identity, cause us to doubt our position with God. And we've all heard those whispers. Well, if you're God's child, then why did this happen? Or if you're God's child, why didn't your prayer get answered on this? Or you're no good. You're not worthy of this. How can you think that you're a child of God? And when we hear those things, we have to dispute those charges. We've got to take that as seriously as we would take it if somebody were to commit identity theft on our bank account. This is far more serious than that. We dispute those charges. And when we hear you're no good, we need to respond. You're absolutely right. I am no good, but my acceptance by God is not dependent on my merits. My acceptance with God is based on Jesus Christ and his loving sacrifice for me. Being a child of God is our core identity. It's so, so important for us to see that, for us to recognize who we are in him. We don't want to let the enemy steal that away from us. Okay, so when Jesus tells his parents that they should have known that he'd be in his father's house, in verse 50, it says they didn't understand what he meant. And I find that fascinating at that point, because given everything that they've experienced up till now, choirs of angels and, a virgin birth. You wouldn't forget that, would you? I mean, that seems like that would stick with you. Even though it's, some commentators will say, 12 years have passed. I'm thinking, 12 years? I think I would remember something like that. I can remember 12 years ago. Tom Brady got injured. The Patriots didn't even go to the playoffs. It was glorious. So I can remember something like that, 12 years ago. I don't think that they forgot. It's just absurd. I don't think they forgot that he's the promised Messiah. I think what this is conveying is their surprise at how he's fulfilling this calling to be the Messiah. This is taking them off guard. This isn't going according to what they had expected was going to happen. And it reminds us of very important truth as followers of Christ, and that is our pursuit of Christ is not going to be totally normal when we understand normalcy in the way we describe it. I love how Leonard Sweet describes people who are not Christians. He didn't like calling people unbelievers or non-believers or non-Christians because it sounds kind of negative. And he was worried that it would come across as being insulting. And he was trying to think, what can I call people who don't share my faith? And then it dawned on him. He said, I'll call them normal people, because there's nothing normal about following Jesus. We have got an invisible friend. I mean, now, I say something like this, and I don't want anybody to think, oh, good, I've been waiting to be as weird as I can be. Doesn't mean that we've got to, this is not an invitation for us to behave strangely, to pray as loud as we can at every restaurant we are so people know we aren't normal. We are weird enough as it is. We don't need to add anything to this at all. But what I'm talking about when I talk about normal, I'm talking about what we call the normal course of life. The idea of pursuing routine endeavors with predictable results. And it doesn't take us very long following Jesus, learning how to do that, that we realize that this is not just a sterile exercise in following certain rules, and it's not about engaging in certain rituals or believing certain creeds. Following Jesus means that sometimes we're going to have to abandon routines so that we can engage in life in ways that stretch us and push us out of our comfort zones. Along the way, we're going to find ourselves, because of our faith in Christ, in situations that we didn't anticipate, being with people that we hadn't originally thought we would be with, called to love and to sacrifice ourselves in ways that we never dreamed we would have had to do. But also along the way, we're going to experience joys that we never would have anticipated, or fight important battles or achieve victories which might otherwise have been sidestepped if we would have remained in the category of normal or normal life. I know that a lot of us right now are pining away for life getting back to normal. We hear that a lot, getting back to normal in this next year. But I don't know. I think we need to allow God to stretch us during these times. I think that these still become great opportunities for us to learn how it is that we can express our love for the Father in ways that take us out of what are the normally anticipated lines of thought or living, allowing him to help us see the opportunities that are there for us to be able to show off his great grace in a very disrupted world right now. Following Jesus isn't normal, but I mean, who wants to be normal anyway? But still, to qualify that, because I make a statement like that and I realize there's all kinds of ways in which we can go, I don't want us to mistake the surprise that we may encounter in following Jesus to mean that God somehow enjoys chaos, or that, you know, he's always out there trying to mess us up because that's just a lot of fun. Because I don't think that's true. I don't think that's true of God, and I don't believe he's the author of confusion. It's just that his ways are above us. But, you know, we notice here in this, it says when he went home with his parents in verse 51, he was obedient to them. And I think this teaches us something as well, that while our Christian walk has surprises, it is not disordered. There is an order to this. And I find that encouraging. Jesus is the Messiah of the world. He's the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords. Later on in the New Testament epistles, he'll say that everything was created through him. And he went home and obeyed his parents, whom he created. That's an amazing thing to me. God's ways are often unexpected, but that doesn't equal random chaos. Sometimes it looks like that. Obviously, sometimes we're in the midst of things and it just feels like everything is spinning off the rails. But we've got the balancing promise of Romans 8:28. God's at work through all of these things to bring about what is a good end result for all of us. It's surprising, but there's still order. And it's God's order, which means that we're usually slow to pick up on what's going on. It's like the old illustration of an embroidery. If you look at the backside of an embroidery, I mean, it's a tangle of knots and a confusing mess, and it makes no sense whatsoever, but you flip it over on the other side, and you've got this beautiful design and artwork that's represented there. And so often, that's what's happening in life. Some of these tangles and messes and things that we see that we're throwing up our hands saying, God, where are you? He's right there. It's just that we can't quite see it yet from his side of things. And that's why we're called to a life of faith, to a life that believes and trusts in his order, even when we can't see it, even when we're not completely aware of what he's doing. So, as followers of Jesus, it's important to remember who we are. We're God's children whom he loves. When I've taught a couple of years ago, I taught at a youth conference, and one of the first things that I had the kids do was repeat something. I've had you guys do it before. I'd like to do it again. I'm going to ask you who you are. Normally, when you say, who are you, you want to respond with your name, but that's just a title. What I want to know is who you are, and who you are is that you are a child of God whom he loves. And so when I ask you, who are you, I want you to respond, I am God's child whom he loves. Who are you? I am God's child whom he loves. And that was okay, but I think we could do better. So who are you? I am God's child. Oh, that's beautiful. And if you live from that revelation, if you live from that knowledge, it changes everything about how it is that we approach life. We don't have to be afraid of things not being normal in this world because we know who we belong to. We know where we're going, and we know who's in control of it all. The King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, who is Jesus, our Messiah and our God. Life is still following God's order, no matter what it is that we see happening, and that's leading us to something good. So let's find our confidence in that as we begin this new year. Right on? All right.